Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books across a wide variety of philosophical topics and areas. Today's interview is with Meir Hemo of the University of Haifa and Orly Schenker of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem about their new book, The Road to Maxwell's Demon, Conceptual Foundations of Statistical Mechanics, just out from Cambridge University Press. Among the very many puzzling aspects of the physical world is this. How do we explain the fact that the laws of thermodynamics are time asymmetric, while those of statistical mechanics are time symmetric? If the fundamental physical laws do not require events to occur in any particular temporal direction, then why do we observe a world in which, for example, we will always see milk dispersing in tea, but never coming together in tea, at least not unless we film the dispersal and then run the film backwards? In their new book, Hemo and Schenker provide a fascinating and accessible defense of the position that the laws of thermodynamics are observer-relative, that the evolutions of physical microstates in classical mechanics have a direction of time but no determinate direction, and that the relation between observers and the dynamics determines the direction of time that we observe and capture in our thermodynamical laws. In consequence, they argue, it's just a contingent fact that we remember the past rather than the future, and Maxwellian demons, perpetual motion machines that can exploit more and more energy while putting in less and less work, are possible. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Meir and Orly.
Hi.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you. It's good to have this interview.
Yeah. So I found your book, The Road to Maxwell's Demon, just, you know, really fascinating and also very accessible because I'm not a philosopher of physics. So it was surprisingly gratifying to be able to read through the book and, you know, see the dynamical equations and so forth, but actually understand what was going on. So that was very important to me. So the book as a whole is propelled by a fundamental problem, which is how we explain the fact that the laws of thermodynamics are time asymmetric, while those of statistical mechanics are time symmetric. And one of the really interesting implications you draw towards the end of the book is that it's just a contingent fact that we remember the past rather than the future. And another one was that, you know, building a Maxwellian demon or a perpetual motion machine is just a practical problem. And I'd like to build towards these claims that they come later on in the book. So maybe to begin, we can you can tell us a bit how you came to write the book, both why this topic interested you and why, in a general sense, you were prompted to write it.
The best way to think about this is to think about. The questions, the deep questions that we think are at the basis of the construction of statistical mechanics. Why is statistical mechanics an important theory? What does it tell us about the world? And there are two such issues that we had in mind. One of them was how to account for the thermodynamic regularities. And the second issue that we thought needed explanation is the arrow of time, which is usually discussed in the context of thermodynamics. Now, we thought that the right approach to answering these two questions concerning the connection between statistical mechanics and thermodynamics was to think of statistical mechanics as actually a theory that takes us bottom up from mechanics to thermodynamics. That is, the foundation of the theory, the main ideas we are allowed to use when we reconstruct the thermodynamic regularities and the arrow of time, are the principles of mechanics only. This is the desideratum. The idea is to take only the principles of mechanics, and if possible, without adding any postulates, statistical or other, and then construct bottom-up everything we need in thermodynamics, everything we want, the regularities, the arrow of time, probabilistic postulates, everything bottom-up from mechanics. Actually, the project can be thought of as a physicalist project in that sense. Everything should be explained in terms of physics, where physics in our discussion here is classical physics. Maybe we can talk later on a little bit about quantum mechanics. But as a starting point, we took classical mechanics as the foundational, as the fundamental theory, as the foundation of the way we think about the world, and construct bottom up from classical mechanics everything we need.
So, in the first chapters, you explain how this problem, the discrepancy between the asymmetry of time and in the asymmetry in thermodynamic phenomena and the symmetry of the physical laws that are the foundation that you're building up from. And it seems like it's one of your important claims is that you can't derive the laws of thermodynamics from those of statistical mechanics, and that these laws are not generally valid. So they are not fundamental, and that they are just regularities of our own, generalizations of our own experience. So maybe you could summarize that discussion in the beginning of the book.
Maybe we should start by saying this. First, this is something that is known, more or less from the beginning of statistical mechanics, that one cannot derive thermodynamics from mechanics only. This attempt is usually associated with Boltzmann, his H theorem and stuff like that. And everybody agrees about this today. Mm-hmm. Now about the issue of fluctuations, we know that there are fluctuations in the world, so which is something that thermodynamics doesn't describe, and in fact the thing about fluctuations is that this is one of the evidence that people took into account when people started to think seriously about statistical mechanics, namely, that we should try to take it seriously because we know that there are fluctuations and we cannot explain fluctuations on the basis of thermodynamics. So, but As to the general validity of the laws of thermodynamics, given the mechanical picture of the world, I mean, this, the issue here is subtle. What we want to do is to investigate whether one can derive, you know, including the fluctuations and everything we know that is true about the world empirically. The question is whether one could derive from the principles of mechanics these empirical generalizations that we know hold in the world. So, you know, part of these generalizations are the ones that exist in thermodynamics. We know that they are not exactly true because we know that there are fluctuations, but we want to recover everything within mechanics. We want to recover everything, including the fluctuations. Then the issue is about whether or not, you know, one can construct Maxwellian demons or anything are even more general than that. But we're not there yet. I mean, in our discussion, so we can talk about this. But the idea here is to give an account on the basis of mechanics, of both thermodynamics in some weak sense, because we have to correct for fluctuations.
Perhaps one way of looking at this, perhaps it would be useful to see our project on the background of the state of art in this field, just very briefly. There are two major theories that both of them are called statistical mechanics. This is well known. One of them takes its starting point from Boltzmann's work, and the other takes its starting point from Gibbs's work. Both of them try to account in mechanical terms, if possible, for the same phenomena that we are after.
Uh-huh.
But in both of them, whereas they start with mechanics, they add some postulates, statistical postulates of two different kinds. And we try to account for these postulates bottom up from mechanics. Each of those two approaches... each of those two approaches has its important insights from which we try to learn, but has also its conceptual problems that we try to avoid. And the result theory that we offer is neither Boltzmannian nor Gibbsian. This is a new sort of approach built on concepts that we may talk about in a minute. And within this new framework, we try to offer a bottom-up, physicalist, mechanical account of the thermodynamic regularities, including the fluctuations.
And by the way, we actually took very useful and interesting and deep concepts from both Boltzmann and Gibbs. But we also, we took from both approaches what we thought was deep and correct, and gave up, you know, the other concepts in each approach, in order to make this fusion.
Right. So, I mean, one of the central ideas that, you know, that I got from the book was the idea of the observer relativity of thermodynamics, and maybe you could explain your, you know, the third way that you are defending in terms of that idea, how that comes in, because that seems to be the idea of the observer relativity seems to play a very important role throughout the book.
Yeah, this is a very good perspective.
Yes. So let me just say, you know, to begin with, I just want to repeat something that we already said, but is really important here, and that is to keep in mind that we're talking about a physicalist approach. So, I mean, of course, we didn't go into that in the book, and we didn't want to go into, you know, philosophical questions in philosophy of mind and so on, even though there is a lot to say. But the idea, you know, the starting point is a physicalist point of view. And so when we say an observer, we mean a physical observer. So that's just, you know, a comment for to begin with.
Okay.
The point is this. We know that there are observers in the world. It's a fact. We know that we are observers, for example, and we are in the world. And so in that sense, when we talk about the fact that the partition of the state space is relative to an observer, what we actually show is that one can give a physical account of the way in which an observer who is a physical system gets correlated with sets of microstates in the state space of the thermodynamic system. You know, that's the issue there about the correlations between the observer and the external world, and so on. There are lots of subtle issues here, but you have to, you know, one has to remember that the approach is a physicalist approach. So whenever one talks here about a relativity to observers or anything like that, it has nothing to do with psychological point of views or subjective perspectives or anything like that. It's a purely physical relationship.
Okay, so, I mean, that is important because, you know, the idea of observer relativity, you know, does generally tend to bring up precisely those sorts of questions, and also, you know, questions of, you know, anti-realism and things like that.
No, there was nothing like that.
Right, right. Let's flesh out your theory a bit in terms of the case of Tammy, the imaginary character who lives in the time reversed universe. And in that part of the book, you summarize that thought experiment by saying that while statistical mechanics is time reversal invariant, each evolution of the universe has a direction of time. So maybe you could explain your view from the perspective of Tammy, or using that device.
Right. Okay. We'll go back to the issue of macrostates later on. Maybe Ollie would want to say something about it, because the stuff about macrostates and their relativity to observers is extremely important in our view. And even when you clean up the everything and you keep in mind your physicalist point of view, still there are subtle issues there. But let me address the issue of Tammy, of the time reversed universe. So here again, what we want to say there is this: it's well known that the laws of mechanics are what is called time reversal invariant, which basically means that if we reverse the direction of time, you know, just put a minus sign in front of the t in the equations, the laws of mechanics will still remain true if they were true with the original direction of time. So that's more, you know, just very very crudely the sense of the term time reversal invariance.
Okay.
And nonetheless, and this is a new. Claim that we have there in the book, we want to say that there is that if one wants to take classical mechanics seriously as a description of our world, then in a sense classical mechanics is incomplete, and one has to add to it a direction of time. And that's a new claim that we have there, because usually people think that the story ends if one says that the laws are time reversal invariant, then it means that there is no direction of time.
Right.
And we think that this is wrong. And here again, the issue of physicalism comes up. Because what we mean by that is this: if you take an instantaneous description of the universe, so at a time, just take a time slice of, and you know, just take all the exact microscopic state of the universe at a time, then according to mechanics, the state is exhausted by giving the velocities and the momenta and the positions of all the particles that make up the universe. That's it. That's the full, complete state of the universe. And nonetheless, we feel we have an experience of a direction of time. It's a fact. It's something we know that. We think that there has to be, from a physicalist point of view, there has to be a physical fact in the world that accounts for our experience, for our feeling, for our sensation, you know. And as far as we can see, there is nothing in mechanics can account for this fact. Unless one adds a direction of time into this instantaneous state, that's the claim in this chapter, in chapter 4, and that is not inconsistent with the fact that the laws are time reversal and that these two things are completely compatible with each other.
So then, let me. You mentioned before the concepts of microstates and macrostates, and I think that's. So let's go back to that issue. What are these different things? How are they related? And you introduced the idea of different partitions of the microstates, that are at the statistical mechanical level. And then sets of them that are microstates at the thermodynamical level, and then of course the relationship between these two things. So that sort of structure there is critical, I think. And maybe you could explain that.
Yes, this is this takes us back a bit to your previous question about the observer relativity.
Right.
What seems to be an observer relativity in our theory. So very briefly, the idea is this. Look, mechanics, classical mechanics, is a theory in which there is no explicit room for an observer. In that sense, formally, it is a theory without an observer, formally. And in this theory, the state space of the universe consists of, all the degrees of freedom of all the particles in the universe. And this is a completely objective a picture of the world. Now, we suggest that this overall total state space of the universe can be thought of as partitioned into two sets of systems, or two sets of degrees of freedom, one of which is an observer that observes the other part, the rest of it. These two sets are objective sets of degrees of freedom. Now, within this state space of the universe that consists of the observer and the observed, there are microstates, of course. Every point in that state, in the representation of the state, is a point. It is a microstate. Now, if the correlation between the observer degrees of freedom and the observed degrees of freedom are such that every microstate, for example, of the observer is correlated with a set of microstates of the observed, we have a one-to-many correlation between the observer and observed, every microstate of the observer, which from a physicalist point of view is identical to the observer's experience of the world, is correlated with many microstates of the observed. Now, these many microstates of the observed make up a macrostate. And in that sense, this accounts for the fact that we, as observers, see the world, the rest of the world, in terms of macrostates. This is the relation between the microstates and the macrostates. And now, in addition to this, this one-to-many correlation creates a sort of partition of the state space of the observed. Given an observer and the way that this observer is correlated with the observed part of the universe, you can partition the observed part of the universe into sets such that each set is perceived by the observer as a set because of this one-to-many correlation. Now, this is one partition of the state space of the observed system, a partition that is the famous partition to macrostates. This is how we account in our construction for the notion of macrostates. And so there is an observer relativity, but this relativity is objective because it is given in terms of the structure of the state space of the universe, in terms of degrees of freedom in the universe. So this is an account of this partition.
So now I'm getting a little bit clearer. So let me just ask, first of all, what holds these? The macrostates are sets of microstates. So I guess the question first of all is what holds them together as sets? And then given your physicalist idea of an observer, I mean, what is it that makes one of the macros, if I've understood, what is it that makes one of the macro states, in effect, an observer, as opposed to the one that's being observed?
First of all, the two sets of degrees of freedom are treated on the same footing. Okay. Both are physical systems, and if they have the right structure, you could exchange the roles. Perhaps the observed can observe the observer in a different situation. This is a pragmatic partition. I take it that you know, not every system in the world can be an observer. The desk we sit next to it doesn't have the right structure to have experiences, whereas our brains presumably do have the structure. But they are no less physical systems than the table in that respect. So we have two physical systems. One of them has experiences.
There may be many questions that arise concerning, you know, what makes a physical system an observer, what makes a system which has an experience, which has a conscious experience, whatever. We don't go into these issues in the book. These are issues in philosophy of mind, which we have a lot to say about, but we didn't say anything about them in the book, almost. But still, I mean, the treatment of the observer as a physical system plays a crucial role in what we do in the context of statistical mechanics. So in that sense, it's important to bring these issues up.
Your question about what holds the microstates that form a macrostate together, this is an important question. So let me try to explain it. The only thing that makes these macrostates of the observed into a set is the fact that from the point of view of the observer, they are indistinguishable. The correlations in the world, in the universe, are such that each of the microstates within a given macrostate of the observer is correlated with the same microstate of the observer. Okay, each of the microstates in a macrostate of the observed, all of them are correlated with the same microstate of the observer. And for this reason, whenever each of the microstates in the observed takes place, the observer has exactly the same experience because that same microstate occurs in the observed, in the observer. Sorry. So this is the only thing that holds them together. It may be the case that they share the microstates in a given macrostate may share some physical feature. For example, they may share the average velocity, or they may share some something like that, or positions, etc. It may happen that they do, and in thermodynamics they do. This is very fortunate. This is what enables us to construct a theory of thermodynamics, but I'll say more about this later. But for now, the main point about the construction of macrostates is that they come about by the correlation, the one-to-many correlation with the observer.
Do they have any... this gets into sort of...
I have to remember one thing, Carol. It's really important because I see it coming up. The thing is this. According to mechanics, whatever happens in the world happens, supervenes on the actual microstate of the universe. And the trajectory and the sequence of microstates through time which the universe undergoes. That's it. So, the fact that there are correlations between the microstate, say my brain state, my microscopic brain state and the rest of the universe, and the correlations are such that I cannot distinguish between various different microstates of the rest of the universe, doesn't bring into existence, anything, the set of these microstates, the part of the rest of the universe. So we're talking here about correlations in an abstract state space that mechanics uses. Mm-hmm. And then one has to translate it back into the physical space where we live, and it's a different story. So the thing is that as a matter of fact, even when I get correlated with in the state space, what one can say that there is a one to many correlation between my brain state and the state of a gas that is in front of me. Nonetheless, the state of the gas is a microstate, is one single microstate, only one of these microstates, which are all correlated with my brain state. Okay. There's no macrostates is a very, the issue of macrostates is very subtle in statistical mechanics, and this is why we devoted a lot of space to explaining it.
Yeah. At this point, let me just, maybe you can review again how exactly this relationship explains the time asymmetry.
So the first step towards this explanation would be to draw a connection between the partition of the state space into macrostates, of the state state of the observed into macrostates, and we have the state space, the subspace of the universe, which is the space of the observed system. And we carve up this observed state space into sets that form macrostates, so that each set contains microstates, all of which look the same to the observer. Right. This is what makes them a set.
Right.
Now we want to ask about evolutions in the world, about the dynamics of systems. Because up to now, all we said was how the observer sees the world at a time. The observer sees the world in terms of indistinguishable sets.
Right.
All right. Now, suppose, for example, that the microscopic state of the observed system starts out in one of those sets, in one macro states from the point of view of the observer. It is a fact in the world that the world starts out in a given microstate, but we don't know which microstate it is. All we can know as observers is that this microstate belongs to a set which is a macrostate, which contains all the microstates that are indistinguishable for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this initial macrostate of the world. Now the question is, how does this state of the world evolve? And how can we account for this evolution? Of course, we know from mechanics that each microstate evolves along a trajectory that is described by the equations of motion of mechanics. And so this set of microstates that form the macrostate from our perspective begins to form a set of trajectories, all of which evolve together as time evolves. We could ideally, of course, solve all the equations of motions of the trajectories of the system that start from the different microstates, all of which form the macrostate. So we have an infinite set of trajectories that evolve together. Now, these, suppose that ideally we could solve these equations of motion, and suppose that we would ask what would be the end points of each of those trajectories, say 5 minutes from now. So we have an initial macrostate, an initial set of microstates. We evolve, we solve the equations of motion for all the trajectories. We let those trajectories evolve from five minutes from now. Mm-hmm. And we ask what are the end points of these segments of trajectories. In general, these endpoints would be spread over the different macrostates of the observed system. Some initial microstates would evolve in a way that would seem to us as belonging to one macrostate. Other initial microstates would evolve to a different set of microstates that form a different macrostate. So there are different macroscopic possible evolutions given the initial macrostate.
Uh-huh.
And this is well known in statistical mechanics. We know that an initial macrostate has different probabilities for evolving to other macrostates within given times. And so what we are after is actually the probabilities of the different future macrostates after 5 minutes. And the way we do it is by a sort of new partition, perhaps, a new sort of sets of points, which is different from the macrostates. Until now, we only partitioned the state space into macrostates according to the indistinguishability for an observer.
Right.
Now, we take the set which formed a macrostate, we let it evolve, but the endpoint, the set of endpoints of that evolution forms a set. And this set, in general, will not coincide with any of the macrostates. If it will form some sort of a blob in the phase space with some shape. Of course, the volume, the Lebesgue measure of that set will be the same, will have the same Lebesgue measure as the initial macrostate, but its shape can be any shape, depending on the dynamics.
Uh-huh.
And that blob, that dynamical blob from 5 minutes from now, will overlap with several macrostates 5 minutes from now. And these different overlaps describe the different possible futures of that system 5 minutes from now. And these different overlaps between that dynamical blob the dynamical evolution of the trajectories, and its overlap with the different blobs, this will describe the possible future macrostates and their probabilities. But perhaps we'll talk about how to calculate these probabilities later on.
That's one of the main issues that we want to, you know, in the book, what we said is that this is the basis of understanding how probabilities can arise in a completely deterministic theory. I mean, this construction, the interplay between the evolution of the blob on the one hand and the way it spreads over the macrostates is, you know, this interplay is the thing that gives us, or that gives rise to, a notion of probability that we think is an objective feature of the world, even though the world is completely deterministic, according to classical mechanics.
And perhaps at this point, it's maybe useful to again to go back to the current major theories in statistical mechanics
that we mentioned before.
Yeah, good.
And for example, the notion of macrostates comes from Boltzmann. Our understanding of macrostates in terms of the correlations between observer and observed is not Boltzmannian. This is not what Boltzmann did. But we do take inspiration from Boltzmann when we talk about these macrostates, because the idea that there are indistinguishable microstates that form a macrostate, comes from Boltzmann.
Uh-huh.
So we developed this idea, but it definitely comes from Boltzmann. On the other hand, the idea that we need to follow the dynamics of the trajectories that start out in the initial macrostate, this is no longer a Boltzmannian idea. Here we depart from Boltzmann, and we took the inspiration for the idea of a dynamical blob from an idea that Gibbs offered in a different conceptual context. Gibbs talks about an ink blob in order to account for his coarse-grained entropy. This is a very different idea from what we have in mind. But really, the inspiration that Gibbs had in talking about the ink blob was a great. This was a great idea, but we took it to a different context. And so so Gibbs doesn't have the macrostates that we use. Boltzmann doesn't have the dynamical picture that we use. So here we have a fusion of both theories and a departure from these two theories already at what we just described.
Yes.
So you mentioned the concept of entropy, which in a sense, I should have brought it up early because it is so central to discussions of thermodynamics, obviously. So maybe you could say what entropy is on your view, or how best we should understand the concept of entropy, you know, given your entire approach.
Well, in thermodynamics, entropy is a notion that is meant to capture the idea the amount of energy that is available to produce work. That's what it is meant to capture in thermodynamics. And in when you go to statistical mechanics, entropy, you want to reserve this meaning. And the way that seems best to do that is to associate entropy with the size or the measure or the bag measure, usually in many situations, of the macrostate in which the thermodynamic system is in at a given time. And you know, when we go to discussing issues about whether or not the second law generally holds, given the mechanical picture of the world, it is something we say in the book, which we think is interesting, is that, you know, the notion of entropy in mechanics, which is the measure of the macrostate, will no longer correspond to the amount of energy that is available to produce work, if, you know, in a world in which the second law of thermodynamics does not hold. And one of our central arguments, you know, by the way, following, of course, others in the literature, we're not alone here. One of our main arguments is that as a general theorem, it is not, you know, as a general thing, the second law of thermodynamics cannot be proved in within mechanics as a general theorem. There is no way one can do that, even though, you know, textbooks in statistical mechanics sometimes implicitly give you the impression that this is just a matter of, you know, of pragmatic, you know, complexities and so on. But there is a counterexample in mechanics to the second law, and that counterexample is Maxwell's demon. And we show that Maxwell's demon is consistent with the principles of mechanics. And David Albert has shown this before in his book. We generalized his result here, and you know, there are differences between what David did and what we do, but in general, that's, you know, it's a project that began with Maxwell, and then Albert took it up, and we continued it, and we think that it's now established that Maxwellian demons are consistent with the laws of classical mechanics.
So what would we need to do to build a Maxwellian demon? Could we? I mean, if it's out of our reach, why would it be? And if it's not, how might we actually realize that?
There are two issues that need to be addressed in this context, or two ways to answer your question. One is this. What we prove in the book is that a Maxwellian demon is possible in mechanics, and the way that we prove it is by using the conceptual framework that I explained before about the interplay between macrostates and the dynamics, the dynamical blobs, as I called them. The interplay between these sets in the phase space. Given this conceptual framework, it is possible to construct a sort of a special harmony between certain macrostates, a certain division, certain partition of the state space into macrostate, and a certain possible dynamics. So this interplay between macrostates and dynamics can give rise to an evolution that is a Maxwellian demon.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we would need in very general theoretical terms, what we would need to do in order to construct a demon would be to construct the suitable harmony between macrostates and the dynamics of the system. Now, if, for example, the macrostates express our experience, as we human beings look at the world, we as observers, then what we would need to do is to construct the right dynamics. But if we take the dynamics in our world as a starting point, we would need to find an observer that has the right macrostates. But in general, the theoretical idea would be to construct a harmony between macrostates and the dynamics. But this is very general, very theoretical, we in one of the appendices to the book we give a more detailed example of a Maxwellian demons along the line of Szilard's engine relating to Bennett's version of Szilard's engine and so on. So we have a detailed example of how this the general direction in which this might be done. But there is another perspective on your question, which I think is more intriguing and more challenging, and that comes out from our construction. And the idea is this: it might be that we are the demons, as Queen would sing. We are the demons, my friends. How can we be the demons? The answer is this. In the book, we analyze the notion of a measurement. What does measurement mean? What is this notion? And we analyze the notion of a measurement using, again, the conceptual tools of macrostates, partition of the state space of the observed system, the measured system, into macrostates, and the dynamics of the system as it evolves over these macrostates. And one result of this analysis of measurement is that measurement can be entropy decreasing. It may be that the process that we call a measurement is such that by the end of the measurement, the entropy of the whole universe is lower than it was before the measurement. It's not a local decrease of entropy that is compensated by an increase somewhere else.
Right.
No, this is a general decrease in the entire world of the entropy. But it may be that when we carry out measurements, every day, every time, whenever we look at something about which we didn't know the state before, we look at it just to find out what its state is, whether the light is on or off, whether, whether the pen is red or blue. Any measurement we make on a daily basis is such, if we are right in our construction of measurements, every such measurement is such that we bring about a decrease of the entropy of the entire universe. Now, this seems, just on first reading, it may seem almost ridiculous given all we know about thermodynamics.
I mean, I've seen very powerful.
Yeah. But what we want to suggest is that this does not contradict the second law of thermodynamics. And why? The answer is that thermodynamics did not and does not treat the context of measurements at all. What thermodynamics does, it tells us this: prepare system, and this preparation involves measurement. Prepare system in some macrostate, and then let it evolve freely. Don't measure it, just let it evolve. This evolution is described by the second law of thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
If this law, of course, is true, we don't know that it is, but suppose that the second law is true. So there is an increase of entropy. But then when we look again, looking at the system decreases its entropy. And recall what Meir said before, that entropy is a measure of the degree to which we can exploit the energy in the world. By measuring a system, we know more about it, and we can exploit its energy. We can build everything around us. How come? How can we build everything? We can because we decrease entropy just by looking at things. And if we realize that this degree does not contradict everything we know about thermodynamics, because thermodynamics is about whatever happens between measurements, then we can understand how we can change the world in the way that we do, and how this is compatible with thermodynamics. We complement thermodynamics. And if this is true, then we are little demons. Whenever we measure something and build something on the basis of this measurement.
So, I mean, there's a couple of issues that are sort of related to what you've just said. But let me just focus on the idea of measurement and the parallel you draw to memory, which we, you know, sort of ordinarily think of as some sort of a mental operation. And it's a result of, or one of the things that you suggest is that it's consistent with statistical mechanics that we can actually remember the future, right, rather than the past, that it's a contingent thing that we remember the past. And I know some people will say that that's just a conceptual confusion. But, I mean, setting that aside, can you explain this view, this relationship between memory and measurement?
Yes. Well, I mean, one could decide that all memory, you know, only in cases where we remember the past, you know, just by definition, and then the issue is not interesting. So what we say is that, you know, you can tell me, I mean, you know, you can tell me whatever you want about the notion of memory as a memory of the past in the usual sense.
Right.
In the book is we show that you know everything that you've said is compatible with remembering the future. So that's the idea. Now, more generally, the connection between measurement and memory is this: we start with a state of the, you know, with the state of the world at a given moment of time, say the present. Then measurement is a description of the possible ways, macroscopic ways, in which the world can evolve, you know, in one direction of time in the future. Memory concerns the other direction, namely we start with the present state of the world, which is a macro state, and we consider the possible ways in which the universe could have been in the past. Now, in the case of measurement, we look at the future direction, and we find out by means of an interaction and detection what the future macro state, the actual future macro state of the world is. In the case of memory, we remember. It's the same thing. We detect the macro state of the universe in the past, prior to the present state, given the present state. So there's a parallel structure in the sense that both involve what we call a detection of the macro state, you know, in the future or in the past, and a sort of collapse, an epistemic collapse onto the macro state that we find out in measurement in the case of, you know, future state and the macro state that we remember in the past. So this is the structure.
So this idea of an epistemic collapse, I did want to bring that up as well, because you do introduce an idea of a classical collapse, which is not apparently the collapse of the wave function in quantum mechanics. Could you explain your concept of a classical collapse?
Yes, we should. Yeah, this is an important thing that you say. What we call the collapse in classical mechanics is completely different from the infamous, notion of the collapse of the wave function in standard quantum mechanics. So it's a completely different notion. Here, The idea is that, nonetheless, we stress that we think it is a very important concept that does work in the understanding of statistical mechanics, of classical statistical mechanics. And again, the idea goes back to the issue that Orly talked about before, namely the interplay between the dynamics and the partition to macrostates. And actually, the collapse is our way of expressing in classical mechanics the fact that, you know, on every occasion, at bottom, you know, when we forget all the stuff about macrostates and blobs, what happens in the world is supervenes on a single trajectory, microscopic trajectory. And when we find out, say, that a system is in a given macrostate, that's what happens. Namely, there could be various macrostates that are possible given the initial macrostate in which we prepare the system. There could be various macrostates that are possible, that are compatible with the dynamics. And the collapse, when we detect the actual macrostate upon measurement, the collapse takes us actually onto that macrostate, which happens to be the actual one,
mm-hmm.
which happens to contain the actual trajectory that takes us from the initial macrostate to the final macrostate. So now this notion of a collapse is important because we don't have access to the microstate, to the microscopic trajectory of our system, or of the world in general. And when we collapse the state onto a macrostate, we're not confined even to just the blob that we started with in the beginning. Namely, there is a sort of an expansion of the microstates, of the set of microstates that are compatible with what we see, and that even may include trajectories that come from other macrostates, you know, that were never instantiated in our past. So this, you know, so the issue is really complex here.
So I think we are running out of time, unfortunately. So let me just wrap it up by asking, what's your next project? Do you have a follow-up project to this particular one, or are you going in different directions, or what's next?
Well, we have two sorts of projects that we're up to now. One is more perhaps afterthoughts of the project that we have in the book. We have some results that we want to apply for other fields, for example, to Bohmian mechanics and so on.
In quantum mechanics in general.
And so this is one direction. But I would like to focus on the other direction. And the other direction is to think more about the status of the observer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because this is perhaps one of the major contribution of our conceptual system, namely to account for an observer in a physical theory in which the observer is not there to begin with. In a mechanical theory without an observer, What does an observer look like? What are the properties of an observer? How to account for an observer? And what are the consequences of the fact that we are observer? So we want to expand this, and we do it. It takes us naturally towards the philosophy of mind,
right?
And so we think we can contribute in that field. Based on what we built here, we take the notions of macrostates and everything that comes out of this notion to explain ideas in the philosophy of mind, Our project there is a physicalist one. We want to offer a coherent type physicalist theory of mind based on the ideas that we developed in the book.
Well, I look forward to reading that because, yeah, that was one of the questions that we talked about a little, touched on earlier with the role of and the nature of the observer. I guess we're out of time now, so I'd like to thank you both very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a discussion.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, and good luck with the next book. I hope to talk with you soon about that. You've been listening to an interview with Meir Hemo and Orly Schenker on their new book, The Road to Maxwell's Demon, Conceptual Foundations of Statistical Mechanics, just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you very much for listening.